From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ken Sanders says there are some people who have a talent for losing money, and he's one of them. In 1985, his marriage was over. He was raising two small kids by himself. His foray into publishing had gone bust. The IRS was after him. He had lost pretty much everything, except, I guess, the books. For Sanders, there were always books in his life. Everywhere he settled, a pile would stack up. And he's always been pretty much dealing in books, since the seventh grade, actually. No kidding. He was always selling them and mostly buying them, always looking for them. Though Ken says in some cosmic way, the books found him, not the other way around. Today in the program, one of the fixtures of Utah, bookseller Ken Sanders, is joining us for a conversation about books, for sure. But this guy has stories about other things, too. So join us after the news.
This is John Shivick from Logan. I've been a sustainer for a year now. I've learned a lot since signing up. For example, I realized that, sure, Doug Fabrizio is a genius. He actually reads the books, watches the films, engages in conversations, but not like he's the only genius. Without the behind-the-scenes characters, those usually unheard on the airwaves, he'd be a guy on a street corner reaching out as far as his voice could carry. I had the pleasure of watching him at work in the studio once and realized how important the things were that Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark did. Do you know how much effort they put into injecting the right music at the right time? Screen calls, passing silent notes and emails back and forth to Doug while he's orchestrating an interview? On air, it sounds so seamless, doesn't it? That's because of who you don't hear. But it's not all them, either. There's another behind-the-scenes group, and it may be the most important one. Whose shoulders does the KUER staff stand on? The contributors, especially the sustainers. They couldn't do it without the powerful force behind the scenes that is us. So dial in right now and pledge to be a sustainer. Then, the next time someone brings up something that they heard on Radio West, turn to them and smugly say, I helped out with that. You couldn't have done it without me.
You can become part of the Radio West team by going online to KUER.org and making your donation. Thank you so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As you may know, we do these book shows a few times a year. We have book experts to join us to give book ideas for the Christmas season and then the summer vacation. And Ken Sanders is always one of those experts. And when the time comes for the reading portion of his turn, he always chooses to read himself. It's often a poem, and it's always delivered with bravado. The dude knows how to read. His passion for books is easy to see. A few years ago, the Deseret News columnist Lee Benson described Ken as a gift from the 1960s, a living, breathing product of the Beat Generation. And looking at him now, there is something very old school about the guy. You'll know what I mean if you go into his bookstore. But Ken has done a lot of things in his life. He raised hell with radical environmentalists in southern Utah. He roamed the desert and ran rivers with Ed Abbey. Helped fuel Salt Lake's counterculture in the 70s and 80s. Ken, of course, collects books, always has, but also stories and friends. And I have to say he's one of the most interesting people around here. So today in the program, we figured we'd have him on the show for a conversation. He's these days proprietor of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City, and he's joining us here in the studio. And welcome back.
Doug, it's a pleasure as always.
I'm not sure if you have a good answer for this, because this has got to be a tough one to explain. What do you love about books? Like, because it seems like you love everything about them. You like the ideas in them, of course. There's the writing part of it, but it seems like you like the smell of them and the feel of them. And can you put your finger on it?
Well, as an aside, I don't believe there's a day in my life in my bookstore that someone that comes in doesn't comment on the smell of the store.
Yeah.
And in a good way.
Sure.
And what people maybe don't instantly understand is what they're smelling is decaying books.
Yeah.
Because it's all paper and it's all turning to dust. It won't last forever, but neither will we. In my varied life, I've read books. You know, my folks claim I was born with the book in my hand.
Right.
That, I don't have any evidence of that. There's no photos showing that. Possibly unlikely. But I've read books omnivorously. I don't remember a time without reading. And that's where the obsession came from, needing more and more books to read all the time. So I start horse trading for them, and then I start dealing in them. Mm-hmm. And the object was always to get more.
Wait. So the object was – the dealing of it part was to get more books for yourself.
To read.
To read.
Then.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, under the guise of pretending to sell them, I don't have a hoarding problem. I can buy 80,000 volumes of poetry if I want to. It's not hoarding, Doug.
So it's the reading. It's the reading. That's when it comes right down to it. It's just the ideas and the stories in them.
As I think back on it, I think it was the artwork and the illustration that got me into good books, because great artists illustrate great books. Maxfield Parrish led me to the Arabian Nights.
Yeah.
Gustave Doré led me to Edgar Allan Poe and The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and all the other great narrative 19th century poetry.
Yeah.
Edmund Dulac led me to the Rubaiyat.
I want to ask you more about Doré and his illustrations of the Raven, because this was kind of an important book for you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, people always ask, well, what's your favorite book? Which, of course, as you know, is a very unfair question. There's no single answer to it. But I would have to look back at, in my childhood, Edgar Allan Poe probably and Lewis Carroll being the two most influential artists or authors to me.
Why?
They're very, very different.
Yeah.
You know, Alice in Wonderland's a little bit different than The Fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah. But they're both surreal and dreamy and scary in some ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's...
They're like a drug trip, both of them.
Yeah. I mean, well, we certainly learned that in the 1960s, I think. Go ask Alice. She's 10 feet tall, sang Grace Slick. I'll spare you my rendition of that, Doug. I can't sing or swim. I do both equally well.
Wait, you can't swim and you run rivers?
Yeah, it's a dichotomy, eh?
Yeah,
they lied to me. They told me when I first started running rivers that you just wear a life jacket. You don't have to know how to swim. Tom Till, the Moab photographer, took me on my very first river trip down Cataract. I was too ignorant to be scared.
How old were you?
Oh, as an adult. No, yeah. I came to southern Utah late, not until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Ken Slight, the famed legendary Ken Slight, taught me how to row a boat. I shouldn't blame him for that.
But you really took to it?
I absolutely loved it.
Why? Just,
well, maybe it's the whole, you know, Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer thing. Being out there in the middle of nowhere on your own and flowing down and exploring and just you a third day of a trip is when the metamorphosis takes place.
Yeah.
You get up in the morning. This is your work. This is your world. This is your job. The real world, aka what we're doing now, doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And that becomes your real world. It takes 3 days for that transformation to take place. And I've observed this over the decades.
I want to ask you about, I find it really interesting that you didn't go to college or didn't even really want to go to college. Because I think that you think, okay, a bookseller is an erudite scholar type, but that doesn't seem to be the way you think about it.
It's not my style. Well, let's go back to high school. It's the 1960s. I was not a troublesome student, but I rarely did what anyone else wished me to, including the teachers or the administration.
You were rebellious?
Yeah, but quietly so, mostly. If I attended class, I sat in the back and read books of my own choosing, or sometimes I sat in the hallways, and mostly the teachers ignored me. I didn't get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I graduated Granite High School with probably the lowest grade point average in the history of anyone that graduated high school.
Wait, I want to explain that. Why? You were bored?
Yeah. I never did homework. I rarely turned in assignments. I had my own agenda, and it included reading and writing of my own. And it rarely synchronized with what the teachers wished me to do. In senior year, Mrs. Proctor, who they had a new humanities class there. We also had a chapter of the SDS on campus.
Explain what that is.
The Students for a Democratic Society, yeah. That kind of denigrated into the Violent Weathermen in the early 70s. Yeah. Kind of like the Black Panthers denigrated into the SLA, the Sibonese Liberation Army, at the same time. She gave me this. I don't think I knew what the word syllabus meant then, but she handed me the syllabus for the class, and I looked it over. I handed it back to her and said, I've read all these books. And she just looked at me, and initially she did not believe me. She came around to my point of view.
But I guess you wouldn't describe yourself as an activist back then, but clearly you were thinking about civil rights, probably the Vietnam War, those kinds of things?
It was huge. I would submit to you, Doug, that President Richard Nixon, live on television, pulling ping pong balls out of a metal cage with our birthdays on them to send us to Vietnam to die, was the world's first reality TV show. And I didn't like it then. And I didn't like high school then. And to try to get back to the answer to the question I think you asked, I had two momentous decisions to make in 1970, the year I graduated from high school. That was also the year of the first lottery, the Nixon pulling the ping pong birthday dates.
Yeah.
I escaped 3 years of prison, high school.
Right.
Why would I voluntarily sign up for 4 more years of prison? That seemed crazy to me. But even crazier was I didn't know a lot at 17 years of age, but I did not want to go to Vietnam. My whole military career would have been in solitary confinement. You want me to do what? That's crazy. Who knows? We'll never know. I would submit to you one of those two decisions— not going to Vietnam, not going to college,
yep.
was right. And the other one, maybe it was wrong, though I doubt I would have. I thought college, I equated college, university and high school, and they're not. You can't. I was wrong about that.
Right.
But if I'd come, what does haunt me, if I had gone to the University of Utah, as I should have in the fall of 1970, probably... the retired Edward Leaders, who has turned out hundreds of writers at this university, I would have met him. There was an incredible...
Brewster Gieselin?
Edward Leaders, Brewster Gieselin, Mark Strand. I could go on and on and on with the incredible literary and artistic talent that came out of this university in the 60s and the 70s. I would have been exposed to those people, and maybe Ed Leaders would have whipped me into it, given me the discipline to be a real writer, which I lack to this day.
That's interesting. I wonder, I'm not sure you're a man who thinks much about regrets in life, and we'll come back to your writing later, but do you think that was part of it? Is that that you just lacked a kind of discipline, someone to actually, as you said, whip you into shape? And do you regret that?
I do. I do regret that because I am still very undisciplined, and I pursued from cowboy to printer to radical environmentalist, you know, whatever I wanted to do, that was the most important thing. It didn't matter if it paid a salary or made money. I didn't care about stuff like that. To this day, I don't have investment accounts I'm 66 years old and you're looking at my retirement. There's nothing else. it would have brought it. I don't know that anyone could discipline me. I'm too stubborn and pig-headed for that.
But how did you conceive of your life? If you thought about it back then, what was the dream? What was the idea that you wanted to do, to be? Did you think about it in those terms?
Well, like a lot of my generation, I certainly we thought we were going to overthrow the world, of course,
yeah.
And that kind of didn't happen, not directly anyway. And I had the same dreams. I think a lot of my generation, I wanted a place somewhere out of the cities. I detested cities. I wanted nothing to do with cities then. All of my travels were to wild places and wild things, Australia, Alaska. up until a year ago, I had never, ever been to Europe in my life. Huh. I regret that now. I had a ball in Paris.
Yeah, yeah. Except for the food poisoning.
Well, yeah, I did kind of get sick. A 2-week free complimentary trip to Paris. I made it 5 days, and then I spent 5 days in bed. But that's enough of that story.
What was the cowboy part? It's interesting. You loved horses for a time, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, at 250 pounds, the SPCA would be after me if I ever tried to get on a horse. But back in those days, that's where I get a lot of my streaks from, the collector, the obsessiveness. They built a summer home up in the Uinta Mountains on the Mirror Lake Highway above Camas in the brand new subdivision of Samac, Camas spelled backwards, right? In the late 1950s, my grandfather and my dad built it with their own hands, and we owned it until the mid-60s, and we grew up there. Well, Dad, in all of his infinite glory, decided, well, he's got it. So we met Tom Simpson, the Simpsons, and the S Bar S Ranch in Marion, Utah, the foothills of Hoyts Peak and the Uintas.
Yeah.
And we practically grew up wild there. Every weekend of the year, we drove up the old two-lane with the rickety bridges up the highway with my dad singing every Friday night, Spike Jones, leave the dishes in the sink, Ma. Each dirty plate will have to wait at the top of his lungs, and he can't sing any better than I can. And we loved that. In summers, we practically lived up there. And so he had to have a quarter horse. He had a registered quarter horse because, by gum, we're cowboys now. He never could ride it. It bucked him off all the time. But Scooby-Doo, he named the horse, of course.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with that outdoor lifestyle and the sense of being connected to the land that farmers and ranchers have.
Yeah.
And so I learned how to get bucked off a horse myself.
What brought you back to the city, though? I mean, ultimately you ended up, you have a store in the city. You were part of Cosmic Aeroplane in the city. I mean, it was that seems very urban, that kind of sentiment for the time.
I wanted to go find a place in the country, I wanted to fall in love, have a wife and a family. And I did that for a while. My long ago marriage lasted 2 years. We got married. We lived in Camas for about a year. When my ex-wife got pregnant with my son, we moved down to the city. My folks helped us buy a house over on the west side. And in 1976, Michael was born, and Melissa came 2 years later. In that 70s period, I was playing a printer. I printed a lot of rock and roll posters out at Vanguard Graphics. Neil Passy, the greatest rock and roll artist ever to come out of Salt Lake City. And Steve Jones, who I had known since 1967, when he and Sherm Clow founded a hole-in-the-wall head shop called the Cosmic Aeroplane at 9th and 9th, next door to Phillips Gallery, that was a real counterculture place in those days, and a lot of other hippy-drippy places that I've since forgotten their names. And Steve was always so generous. He soon moved over to South Temple and 4th West, which was cavernous no man's land. It was alky bars and dive hotels and the Greyhound bus depot. Yeah. And it was pretty, it about killed his business because nobody went to the west side then. It's now the steps leading up to the Delta. I mean, I'm always going to call it the Delta Center.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And Ben's Railroad Exchange Bar was next door. Mrs. Taylor, Ophelia Taylor's Cafe, Black Cafe, was around the corner. The waiters in the porter's bar that was for the train workers, the African-American train workers, they weren't allowed to drink in the white bars in my own youth. And that just seems, I don't think I was very aware of that at the time, but you became aware of it.
Where did the rare books part, when did that start to develop? At what point did you start to think about these really exciting first editions and these rare books?
Oh, by junior high school.
Really?
14 years old, went to Southern California. My grandfather took me to Bertrand Smith's Lake Acres of Books, 240 Long Beach Boulevard, Long Beach, California. We also went to Knott's Berry Farm, deep sea fishing. Pop sat outside, that's what we called my granddad, chain-smoking unfiltered Camel cigarette, sitting in his old battleship gray Ford, that he would die a horrible death of cancer from those cigarettes at the age of 62 in later years. And he just let me loose in that store for hours. I bought, back to Gustave Doré, I bought a giant folio-sized edition of The Raven by Poe, with every quatrain of the poem had an engraving by Doré. I bought a Gwynedd Hudson illustrated Alice in Wonderland, a Maxfield Parrish Arabian Nights.
But did you know what you were buying?
Yes.
You did.
That Doré cost me $17.50.
Wow.
It's worth about $2,000 now.
So what's exciting about that? The idea that they had worth?
No.
What was it? No. What?
Because I'd never seen them before. And it just, the words and the pictures, again, the pictures just spoke to me. And I lusted after them. I had to possess them. And I read them. I mean, I loved them.
You said this one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's
yes, sir.
Interesting. It's that you don't find the books in some kind of cosmic way they find you. What do you mean by that, if you can say?
It's true. I mean, certainly in my youth, I hunted books, and I suppose I still do a little bit, but books appear to me. They find me. Every single day in the shop, people drag in dozens to hundreds to thousands of books, 95% of which we turn down because they're not of interest to me and I can't or don't wish to sell them. But I don't go to thrift stores or DIs. I don't go to estate sales. Books find me. They manifest themselves to me. And people if I walk down the aisle of a book fair, people say, oh, hey, I've been saving this for you. Huh. You know, there's an advantage to having done this for doggone near 50 years,
yeah.
Doug.
What makes you good at it?
Oh, boy, I didn't anticipate that question. Am I good at it? Well, I've survived doing it.
Yeah,
I guess I have a certain talent for it. Okay, I have an answer. You have to be able to transcend your own tastes, maybe even your own beliefs to an extent. Mm. You have to be able to look at something and see its worth when you don't know the book, you don't know the author. And you learn to train yourself to look for things you've never seen before. I'm always picking out of a bunch of books that I've purchased, and this is odd. I don't know this publisher. And it's just a sense I have, and I'll hand it to one of my catalogers and say, I'm not going to price this $5 or $10 like I normally would. Look this up. And more times than not, I'm right. It's something really special and unusual. It's worth a little bit more. But it's not the value. I don't care what the book's worth. Yeah, it's always impressive, you know,
to
$100,000 for a Book of Mormon. That catches people's attention, of course. But it's not what motivates me. If I can't buy books and sell them for a profit, I'm not going to stay in business very long. I'm not trying to be too spiritual or altruistic here, but I'm not. I like to think that I'm not a greedy person, except when it comes to food, and drink.
You mentioned one of the things that you have to be willing to do is transcend your own beliefs, which I think is a decent segue into the Mormon rare books.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about that when we get back from a break.
Okay.
Ken Sanders is with us. He is the proprietor of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. And we're going to take a break. We'll come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with bookseller and Legend, can we call you that? Legend? Ken Sanders? Legend around here.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I went back. It was interesting you said before we went to break that one of the things that makes you good or can make you good in terms of evaluating, you know, ancient books, old books, rare books, is you have to be able to transcend your beliefs. And this gets us into the fact that you are something of an expert on Mormon rare books. How did that come about? Because you're not – You have a pretty good Utah pedigree. You have, let's see, Heber Kimball's – one of Heber Kimball's wives was your great-grandmother.
His Heber C. Kimball's favorite polygamist wife, Ellen Sanders Kimball, was a great-great-aunt of mine.
Aunt, okay.
I come down from her brother's lineage, Sandra Sanders, who translated the Book of Mormon – into Maori.
Wow.
Think New Zealand, 1880. That would have been a wild place to have been.
Was your family ever Mormon? I mean,
Of course. My grandfather served a mission to Hawaii in 1920 to an LDS mission to Hawaii, sure. 1920 to 22. He came back and he wasn't a Mormon. My father was baptized.
It's not your pacemaker if you have one. And if people hearing the noise, there is a fire alarm that has just gone off. This is live radio. And so we're going to try to ignore it. You'll hear a little pulse going on. Is that going to drive you crazy?
No, I just thought it was me.
No, it's not.
I swear I turned the phone off. So Dad, my mom made my little brother and I go to the local ward house when we were kids.
Yeah.
But the religious part never stuck with me. It was, you know, parties and tubing and social activities.
Yeah.
The religion stuff went right over my head. But so I am not a Mormon. I don't ever pretend to be LDS in order to sell a book. I go out of my way to tell the story I just told you.
Yep.
What I see my store is doing, you'd be some kind of fool not to sell LDS books in an LDS community.
Sure.
And yes, it transcends my belief, but we treat Mormonism as history. We have the good, the bad, the ugly. My job isn't to proselytize for the LDS faith or against them. I'll talk to you all day long about the books and the history.
Yep.
I don't want to get into the theology.
Personal
belief and faith is just that. And I don't like to cross that line.
When you first got your hands on a first edition Book of Mormon, was that pretty exciting?
It was in the Cosmic Airplane days in the late 1970s. And yes, I revere and worship the book, but from a completely different perspective than faithful LDS people do. It's exciting. It's exciting to this day to see one. And once in my entire career, I got to handle the sale of the rarest LDS book and the most valuable LDS book, the precursor to the Doctrine and Covenants, 1835.
Is the Book of Commandments?
The 1833 Book of Commandments, which the distinction between it and the DNC, the revelations from God are given to individual apostles, not just to Joseph Smith.
There's this story. I was reading an article, transcript of a piece that NPR's Howard Berkus did. This was a few years ago when the book "The Man Who Loved Books Too Much" came out.
Oh boy!
And you're a feature in it, of course. You're one of the main characters. You're the person going after the thief. This is famously John Charles Gilkey.
Yes.
And Howard reported about the time when you chased a thief out of your store and ran after his car.
Yeah, that would be the Jesus thief. Let me go back to Gilkey first of all.
Yeah.
I was the security chair for the ABAA, the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, and what the book thief and the Biblio detective, as I fancied myself, have in common. That later got denigrated to a much shorter term. We won't say that on the air. But you can use your imagination.
Yeah.
I became obsessed with this thief that was stealing from my colleagues. Long story short, 3 years of my life devoted to it. I put him in San Quentin.
Yeah.
Never met him to this day. But yes, in the early days of my downtown shop, when only my daughter and I worked there, and she went off to a dental appointment, a guy comes in trying to sell me some worthless books. I didn't like his books, didn't like his looks. I told him no, but I made my mistake. He set the books down, said, I'm going to look around. Should have just booted him out of the store right then and there. I didn't do it. I've learned. You learn over the years.
Yeah.
He went in the back of the store. I kept an eye on him. He starts to come up, and he's going to leave. I'm behind the counter. He's in the – there's kind of a 20-foot-long hallway to takes you to the front door, and it's all framed with glass objects. He doesn't know that I can see his reflection in the glass. As he reaches the front door, he grabs a painting of Jesus Christ off the wall and runs with it. I didn't think about it. I just ran after him. It's a snowy December day. His girlfriend's parked at the curb with the getaway car. He slams the car door in my face. I start kicking in the side of the door, and I broke the side window. I punched the window out of the car until I had this jagged hole, and I reached in and grabbed him and the painting and started trying to pull him out through the hole. And his girlfriend, he's swearing at his girlfriend, drive, drive, drive. And she finally hits the gas, leaves me lying on my back with bloodied hands, no painting, in the snow, memorizing his license plate number. 2 hours later, I get a phone call. I'm sorry I took something that was worth so much to you. It's my Jesus thief. He's calling me from a Village Inn pancake house in West Valley. He's from a payphone. He's abandoned the painting there and is telling me where to go pick it up.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's an obsession.
Yeah. How do you describe your relationship with late great Edward Abbey? What was it like? Friendship for sure, but
Ed was certainly a mentor.
Yeah,
Ed Abbey's been gone 29 years as we speak.
Wow.
Ed, if you want to know, when Ed Abbey was alive, he didn't need anybody to speak for him. And since he's been dead, an awful lot of people do it. And I resent that. I avoided it for the longest time myself. But sometimes I like to set the record straight. Like all of us, he was a very complicated person. He usually in person was very, very quiet. He was, like most writers, the fly on the wall type,
Mm-hmm.
But Ed loved to provoke people. He wanted to get you out of your skin, make you uncomfortable, and make you think about things. And he would go to sometimes ridiculous lengths to do that. He took such pride in writing, and I believe he published this in one of his books. In the 70s, he wrote Gloria Steinem a letter at Ms. Magazine. And of course, he starts it out, "Dear Sir." But she got it entirely and gave it right back to him big time.
Yeah.
And it just, he was never more proud when he had the left and the right. up in arms against him.
Yeah.
That made him happy, I think.
Did you ever talk about writing?
Not very often. Once we were doing a hike, a summer he spent writing the last big novel, the fat masterpiece, the Fool's, as he called it, The Fool's Progress.
Yeah.
He subtitled it An Honest Novel just to annoy the heck out of the critics. We were taking a walk up above Pack Creek, Ken and Jane Slate's Pack Creek down Moab, and he was having a problem with the sequence, and I think he was just talking out loud. It's not like he really was seeking my advice on it or anything. One time, during one of the river trips down in the Canyonlands, the Maze, we spent all day long, there were three of us, my friend Sarah and Ed, down in a park called Ernie's Country, and I failed to find a slot canyon I was taking them to, so they were ribbing me unmercifully, the great Pathfinder.
Yeah.
All day long, we're tired, we're exhausted, we're back up on the Dollhouse Road, the sun setting over all that great Canyonlands country. Ed kind of strokes his beard, and he says, "Yeah, out there somewhere, I'm glad to see this country looks somewhat I wrote about on that Monkey Ranch gang. This is what I imagined it looked like when Hey Duke winches his Jeep down off the cliff. And Ed Abbey admitted to me he'd never set foot in that country when he wrote that scene in the book.
Do you know where he's buried?
I deliberately have never gone there.
But you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we should tell people who don't know that it's kind of a secret.
Well, it's out in the middle of the Cabeza Prieta. Knock yourself out. Go find it. But what's the point? Right. Why don't you read his 21 books instead? It's like in the 60s. Remember Carlos Castaneda and the Don Juan, the Yaqui magic shaman. I love those books at that time frame, especially the first three.
Yeah.
But the point wasn't to go take magic mushrooms and go to Mexico and search for Don Juan. That wasn't the teaching of the books. That wasn't the truth of those books. And people misinterpreted that. And this obsession, I find it unseemly. Who cares where he's buried under a big pile of rocks in the Cabeza de Prieta down on the Mexican border? Yeah, go knock yourself out. Go find him. I'm not going to.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Wendell Berry. He has a special place in your heart, it seems.
I think in many ways, especially literary ways, I've been privileged to have known and got to be very good friends with many, many extraordinary literary figures, Ed Abbey, Chuck Bowden, Wendell Berry. I first met Wendell, so to speak, in the 1980s when I was doing my Edward Abbey Western Wilderness author's calendar. And there's just something that struck a chord. I'd read Unsettling of America in the 70s. We became good friends. We had a lot of adventures together. He came out here for Ed Abbey's wake in 1989. He wrote this beautiful piece talking about the works of Edward Abbey are antidotes to despair. And, I'm sorry, I'm blowing it. We are living in a time of punishment and ruins. The works of Edward Abbey are antidotes to despair. He's just a beautiful, beautiful man. I spent a week living in his home with him and Tanya, up every morning at 6 a.m. with the rolling mist off the Kentucky River, harvesting his neighbor's tobacco. He taught me. There were a bunch of really old men out there, and one was really old, and he was mad because he had to drive the tractor because he was too dang old to work anymore, and he wasn't happy about it. And out there in the sun and the humidity, and I'd never seen a tobacco plant in my life. They're like giant radioactive cabbages. The leaves are bigger than elephant ears. Yeah. They're huge. And that is really hard work. And Wendell Berry taught me to listen to those old men, the words they use, the cadence of their speak. And that was in the 80s, early 90s, that whole language and culture has disappeared off the face of this earth. I never would have been exposed to it without Wendell Berry, my guide.
Will you read something from Wendell?
I would love to, Doug. he has written far more than 50 books since Nathan Coulter was first published in 1960. There's not a bad one in the batch. I consider Wendell Berry the poet, the farmer, the essayist, the counterculturist, the social activist to be the most important living writer in this country. Over the years, he's written a whole series of poems, I think to let off steam.
Yeah.
Called Manifesto. They're called the Mad Farmer Liberate. Mad Farmer poems. This is my favorite. Manifesto, the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance, for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophecy, such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields, lie easy in the shade, rest your head in her lap, swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. Wendell Berry. I think that pretty well articulates the state of political affairs and the culture that we live in today.
You know, let me ask you this finally. It's not too late to start a writing career.
I hope to do. I do write.
Yeah, do you?
Two years ago, I wrote my first ever song.
Oh.
We don't have time to do it. It's called Bullet Holes for Breakfast.
What about books?
I'm working on things. I have an essay about Abby and stuff coming out in some anthology. I have a 100-page manuscript written that I need to finish called R. Crumb Meets the Monkey Wrench Gang from when I published R. Crumb Illustrated Edition, The Monkey Wrench Gang. I'll try and do it. But we got to talk about, just quickly, artists, and when I say artist, I mean writers, I mean painters, I mean musicians, I mean, you know, art with the big A. I mean art and culture, which is, we're doomed without it, you know, poetry and civilization. We don't do enough to support our artists, and we have so many great ones. We have Trent Harris, the filmmaker here. We have Scott Carey, the independent journalist. We have Alex Caldiero, the self-proclaimed sonosopher. We've got Amy Irvine, the great writer. We've got so much talent in this town, and I'm here to tell you, we do not do enough locally or state or federally to support our artists. We've always had great artists here, going back to the days of the Logan poet Mae Swenson and the African American writer Wallace Thurman. We've got to do more to support our artists, and that means money. We got to do more for social justice, and that's what this radio station does. And I'm going to go on a quick, this is a fund drive. This is the fundraiser. So send in money. Save civilization. Keep Doug Fabrizio could be on the national stage anywhere he wants to. And we've got him here, right here in Salt Lake City, folks. Call in those $1,000 pledges right now so we can keep him here and he doesn't run off to some big state environment. I'll shut up now.
Save civilization. That's a good pitch.
We'll see if it works.
Ken Sanders, proprietor of Ken Sanders Rare Books. If you've never been down to his store, you should. Meet him. He'll have a story for you. And maybe on a Friday night, a shot of bourbon.
Is that legal?
I don't know. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directed the show. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.